You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
I'm Anoush Samarodi, host of the WNYC podcast Note to Self, sitting in for Leonard Lopate today. June was the strongest month for job creation so far in 2016, and unemployment is now at a relatively low 4.9%. But a growing body of research suggests that huge percentages of Americans could lose work to machines in coming years. Think self-driving cars, news reports written by computers, not journalists, automated legal documentation, and robotic medical diagnoses. Blue-collar and white-collar jobs will both be affected, and it sounds worrying. But who nowadays would choose horses over cars, or payphones over smartphones, or even snail mail over email? Okay, maybe that last one's not good. We want to get rid of email, don't we? Well, Thomas H. Davenport and Julia Kirby look at ways we can benefit from what they call the third era of automation in their new book, Only Humans Need Apply, Winners and Losers in the Age of Smart Machines. It's published by Harper Business, and I'm so pleased that it brings Babson College professor in management and information technology, Thomas Davenport, to our show today. Hello, Tom.
Happy to be here.
All right. So you say we're in the third era of automation. Let's back up a little. Let's talk about the first two. What are they and how do they compare?
Sure. So this goes back a ways. One could argue that, the first revolution from technology and automation was the Industrial Revolution, where people were automated out of jobs in textile factories and farms and so on. That was 18th and 19th centuries generally. And then in the 20th century, we had a lot of service-oriented jobs begin to be automated. Not fully, but a lot of that. So, you know, when we go to airports these days, chances are pretty good we get our tickets from a machine. We get cash from ATMs. Mm-hmm. So many of those kind of transactional service jobs were automated in that era. And now I think it's fair to say we're in a third era involving the automation of knowledge work, which we always thought was safe from incursions by smart machines or machines in general. But a lot of these new artificial intelligence, cognitive technologies are oriented to making decisions and using judgment in ways that previously only humans could do.
So you use the terms, various terms like artificial intelligence, cognitive technologies, also deep learning. These are all different ways that computers not quite think, but sort of. What are they? Are those different terms? And when did these start becoming used so that you think it sort of started off this third era?
Well, that's a kind of a long diatribe in itself that you probably don't want to get into the details of.
Oh, I'm into it. Bring it.
Artificial intelligence was, of course, the earliest term that people used for this. And this has been going on for almost 50 years with various kind of, people refer to it as winters and springs of either enthusiasm or, I guess, depression about the prospects that these smart machines could really do much. And then I think my view is that cognitive technology is really just an alternative term for artificial intelligence, maybe kind of getting around some of the long history around that term that we'd rather forget at times. Things like deep learning, machine learning, are sort of subsets of either cognitive technology or AI. They are particular approaches to making, intelligent decisions and judgments.
But so just for an example, making sure I get this right. So it's something like Google Photos. It automates uploading your photos, but the deep learning part of it is that it can recognize that there are people in the photos or airplanes, or it starts to be able to categorize and sort of quote unquote think for you.
Yes, I think recognizing cats was the big step forward for Google's deep learning. So one of the great achievements of humankind, I think, that we can recognize cat pictures.
Cats, we had no idea how important they were until certain social media platforms came along.
Amazing.
So if we look at what those things can do, how do they oust workers? What sort of jobs do they take over? Because we're not totally seeing that yet, right?
No, it's still early days, and I think if there is good news about this, these things tend to move relatively slowly. I mean, even on the administrative jobs, one number that always sticks with me is in 1980, we had about 500,000 bank tellers in the United States. And in 2016, we have, surprisingly, about 500,000 bank tellers.
Really?
Yeah. It's somewhat shocking. Now, we have 50% more people in the United States than we had in 1980. So we are clearly on a per capita basis not adding bank tellers at the rate that we might. But people find other things to do, and they specialize in more complex transactions. And things like, you know, ATMs and online banking just take a long time to put people out of work. There are even a surprising number of travel agents in the U.S. still. So it takes a while for these things to happen. But the kinds of jobs that are threatened now are really the thinking-oriented jobs. And I should say, not whole jobs yet. It's typically tasks within those jobs. That's one of the other saving graces of all of this, is that very few technologies could replace an entire lawyer or an entire doctor, but they can do a very good job, for example, of, you know, diagnosing radiological images to see whether there's something that might be potentially cancerous on it, or looking through vast numbers of documents to see whether one might be relevant to a legal case. Those things they can actually do in many cases better than humans, even though it doesn't mean that, you know, too many radiologists have lost their jobs yet. But it does limit the growth, I think, and I suspect in many of those fields, as in bank tellers, nobody would necessarily say this is a great growth path to go on.
I'm Anoush Samarodi, sitting in for Leonard Lopate, and I'm talking to Babson College professor Tom Davenport. His book is Only Humans Need Apply, Winners and Losers in the Age of Smart Machines. Okay, so you suggest thinking, I love this, you suggest thinking in terms of augmentation rather than automation. What do you mean by that? This is sort of an optimistic take on what has largely been a very gloom and doom topic, this idea of the robots taking over from people.
Yes, we do. We try to offer some hope in all of this. And I think there is, for people who are willing to, you know, learn how these machines work and how they can add value to them in the workplace. So augmentation is basically smart humans and smart machines working alongside each other in various ways. We try to illustrate what some of the ways are. And in some cases, it might be the machine doing most of the thinking. And in some cases, it might be the human doing most of the thinking. I mean, one great example is if you've had surgery recently, you might know there's this thing called a surgical robot. And it sort of gives the surgeon superpowers, but doesn't really decide what to do at all. The surgeon is really in charge. So there, you know, most of the brains are coming from the surgeon, and the arms and hands and the eyes are assisted by the machine. In some other cases, it might be the machine doing most of the work, but the human kind of stepping in when things go awry or when there's an exception to the rules or whatever.
There's a CEO who you talk about in the book. Her name is Camille Nisita. I believe she's in Detroit. Can you sort of give her example and tell us how this proves your point about augmentation?
Yeah, well, she's CEO of a digital marketing company. And digital marketing is already an area where there have been a lot of inroads from smart machines. In a way, there have to be, because there's so much data and the decisions need to be made in such short time. If you're going to a website and you see an ad that's been placed on that website, typically the decision about what ad should go where, you know, supposedly targeted to you, although sometimes I'm sure we all have our doubts about how targeted they really are, has to be made in about 15 milliseconds using all the data from your cookies and so on your computer. No human could really do that. But Camille and a number of other people in digital marketing have argued that, the kind of short-term execution-oriented decisions have to be made by machines, but the big picture thinking about, you know, does this kind of campaign make sense overall, and what overall things might appeal to a customer under certain situation, that's still, I think, the province of human beings, and So there's still, you know, I think plenty of work in that field.
So I wonder also, is that similar to like brokers? We don't see a lot of them on the floor of the stock exchange anymore, but they need to do the sort of high level strategy and thinking.
Yeah, you know, I don't know if anybody's been to the New York Stock Exchange. It's a little depressing recently because...
Tumbleweeds.
Yeah, the brokers are, I think, basically there for TV more than anything else.
Right.
And there's no open outcry trading. All the decisions about what stocks to buy are made in a server farm in New Jersey, basically. Yeah, I'm not sure the floor people are making those big picture decisions, but certainly if you're in... equities trading or bond trading or whatever, the high level thinking about what the strategy should be is still reserved for humans.
But are there other jobs, like for example, from what I understand, law schools are seeing declining enrollment because there is less work for lawyers nowadays. Is that the case, that these are not possible? They cannot be augmented in ways that the two other jobs that you mentioned, digital marketing and stock trading?
Well, I think there's certainly a number of legal tasks that can be automated, but a number that can't. You know, discussing the case strategy with your client, or, you know, providing wise counsel, those things that we always think of as lawyers doing, at least senior ones. Those are still for humans, but the challenging thing is they're mostly for senior lawyers, and it's the entry-level people who take it on the chin in many cases,
right,
with automation. So I think that explains part of why there's this glut of entry-level lawyers out there for the number of jobs available, and the fact that a lot of the work they did in the past was this sort of document review, kind of legal grunt work, if you will, and more that is being done by machine.
So I want to get into what someone whose work has been affected or may be affected by automation can actually do to be positive about this, to take a practical action on this. You actually describe five steps or options for augmentation. What's the first one?
Well, the first one, and I think sort of the quintessential augmentation step, is what we call stepping in. It's basically working closely day to day with a smart machine and knowing its strengths and weaknesses and knowing when it needs to be augmented by human judgment and stepping in if there's a problem. Since we're in New York City, I can give you a good example of a New Yorker who plays that role, a guy named Andy Zimmerman, who's a teacher in Brooklyn. And New York City schools have done a great job with something called School of One. It's a technology that uses something called adaptive learning to figure out just what kind of content a student needs at any given
mm-hmm.
time. And you might say, well, what does that leave for the teacher to do? Is it just about discipline or whatever? So I interviewed Andy, and it turns out that he does a lot still. He's quite aware of what the adaptive learning systems are good at and bad at, what online content sources are available, and he'll often say, Sally needs to learn more about geometry,
mm-hmm.
and the Khan Academy, just as an example, the Khan Academy geometry units are really not as good as some other ones.
Mm-hmm.
So he would refer her in that direction. So
personalizing that.
Yeah, personalizing the personalization in a way. So it takes a lot of work. And Andy, like a lot of the people we discovered who are stepping in, are kind of, you know, technically oriented people. They like technology. They are interested in how it works. And he's done enough learning so that he can really add value to what the computers do.
I'm talking to Professor Tom Davenport about how technology is changing the American workforce. He's a professor of management and information technology at Babson College. He's the co-founder of the International Institute for Analytics and a fellow of the MIT Initiative on the Digital Economy. He's also co-authored a book with Julia Kirby called Only Humans Need Apply: Winners and Losers in the Age of Smart Machines. It's published by Harper Business. We're going to hear more from him after the break. I'm Manoush Samarodi, host of WNYC's Note to Self. In today for Leonard Lopate, this is WNYC and WNYC.org, and we'll be back with more just after this break. Mm-hmm. I'm Anoush Samarodi, sitting in for Leonard Lopate. I'm with Thomas Davenport. He's the author of Only Humans Need Apply, Winners and Losers in the Age of Smart Machines, comes from Harper Business. Okay, so Tom, when we went to the break, we were talking about jobs that still require a human touch. And actually, I did an episode about this on my show a little while back. Mm. And one of the people that I talked to was a trainer at my gym who was talking about motivation, these very human emotions that, yeah, you can have an app on your phone, a workout app, but actually like feeling like you need to get there and working to your maximum ability, all these things. What are some other jobs that you don't see necessarily being affected or being affected in ways that we may not think they'll be affected?
Yeah, so we call your personal trainer's category of activity stepping aside. It's doing things that computers aren't particularly good at, and there's more and more of that sort of thing necessary. I think as we automate the kind of basic decision-making, we have to motivate people. A number of my students teaching in Boston work for big financial companies, Fidelity and so on, and they say, you know, we're feeling like the wealth management, asset management is getting much more scripted and computerized. Mm-hmm. But one student said, I feel the need to be a financial psychiatrist, basically, you know, persuading people to do the right thing in investing and getting husbands and wives, you know, on the same page as far as financial risk and so on. So I think also jobs that are highly creative, that are highly empathy oriented.
So does that mean managers actually will continue to be needed? That middle management who like keeping people, you know, scheduling sick time and all these things that happen to humans but may not happen to robots?
Well, I think there will be two different types of managers, really. There will be some that are highly empathetic and do still manage a lot of people, and then there will be some who manage the machines, and mm-hmm. we call that stepping up. It's going back to what you were saying about investing. A hedge fund manager, all the stocks and bonds are traded by computer, but he or she kind of sees the big picture about where the markets and the economy are going and are able to make, you know, large scale changes in how things work. And, you know, I gather that's a pretty highly paid profession, so
yes.
It must be a good thing to do these days. So, that's stepping up, stepping in, and stepping aside. And then there's some things that are just really narrow that a computer wouldn't automate. I thought of this once I was reading about a guy who buys and sells Dunkin' Donuts. He connects buyers and sellers of Dunkin' Donuts franchises. And I thought, buying and selling, you know.
That sounds pretty automatable.
Well, think eBay. It's very good at connecting buyers and sellers of things, but that's such a narrow area. It seemed unlikely that somebody would take the time to automate
it. Right, right.
Or somebody was telling me that his cousin was in a commercial litigation law firm practice, and he thought, this is too crowded. I'm going to switch to automated garage door opener failure cases, which is unlikely to be automated.
Way to specialize.
Yeah, exactly. So more and more special.
On a more sort of a bit of a downer note, what are some of the jobs that you're like, yeah, those are not going to be around? There's just no way. I mean, as a journalist, I think about that. It's one of the reasons why I like doing radio and podcasting. My husband is on cable news, which as we know, you know, people are cutting the cord more and more often.
Yeah. Well, I think a lot of sports journalism is already automated and more will be. Anything that involves, a lot of data or could benefit from a lot of data. Financial journalism, most earnings reports now from the Associated Press are done by machine. You know, maybe a detailed analysis of Apple's latest quarter would still be done by a computer. But if you're a small firm or a small football team or something like that, you know, no human will write about your performance. It's those kinds of highly structured, highly data-oriented jobs. I think computers are just better than we are at those.
Can we just look on a sort of on a macro scale? Has the federal government done any estimates on how cognitive technology will affect employment or the economy or different sectors of our society? For example, is it the middle class that's going to be squeezed disproportionately?
No, the federal government has been largely absent from this discussion, and you don't hear it much in from political candidates either.
Yeah, you really don't. I mean, if anything, though, that you see the president and presidential candidates going to factory floors and saying, I'm going to bring back more jobs like these. Does that seem very short-sighted to you?
Well, I think as factories become more and more automated, it is conceivable that manufacturing will move back to the United States in greater numbers, but not necessarily jobs. We'll need a few. And again, these are people who can really step into manufacturing technology and understand it and fix it when it breaks and so on. But the number of jobs is not going to be very big. I think that's fair to say.
So we haven't seen necessarily any data then that says here's what's happening. Or is it just too early in this transition that you write about?
Well, you know, there was an Oxford University study that got quoted a lot saying that 47% of U.S. jobs are automatable. But that was a little suspect, I thought, because when they said only 35% of U.K. jobs were automatable, as if they're somehow smarter than we are over there. And two, they didn't give any date by which these jobs would be automated. So I don't think, and nobody can have that level of precision. I think nobody knows
how. But are we talking 10, 20, 50? What are we?
My sense is much more likely to be in the 10% range in the next 30 or 40 years anyway than in the, you know, 50 or so range. It's just, as I say, it's tasks, not jobs, that get replaced. And there are too many things that computers just aren't good at yet. Maybe someday they will be, but it's hard to say exactly what the trajectory of improvement will be.
I mean, in the past, you know, there's the, I think it's unclear whether this is a true story, but the Luddites, Ned Ludd, right? He is the one who, I believe it was the, is it weavers that were revolting?
Weavers smashing the textile machinery that took over some of their jobs. Yeah.
And at what point do you start to see sort of political upheaval when jobs get affected?
Well, that's an interesting question. I mean, we didn't see much of that in the U.S. at all. And, you know,
because that was in England, right?
We don't tend to be very, you know, armed revolution oriented in the U.S. I suppose it's conceivable that that would change. You know, we could see a bunch of lawyers marching down Wall Street and saying we want to take back our jobs.
Or you could look at the support for Trump as that, couldn't you?
I think there isn't certainly an automation element in the support for Trump and Bernie Sanders that a lot of jobs have been already taken away, as I mentioned, the kind of mostly lower end service jobs and manufacturing jobs before that. And we haven't found a good way to reemploy a lot of those people.
I'm talking to the author of Only Humans Need Apply, Winners and Losers in the Age of Smart Machines. It comes from Harper Business, and it is co-written by Professor Tom Davenport. I'm Anoush Samarodi, sitting in for Leonard Lopate. You're listening to WNYC and WNYC.org. So, okay, autonomous weapons. Can we talk about the sort of the defense side of this? Robots are more involved in the police force. There was a manifesto that came out signed by numerous technologists saying that we need to be very cautious when automating a lot of our defense overseas. What are some of the implications of that?
Well, yeah, there was a big uproar that a recent lone terrorist, the one in Dallas, I believe, was killed by a bomb-carrying robot. But so far, those have been, and the drones that fly over the Middle East and so on, have been kind of like the surgical robots I was mentioning earlier. They've been piloted remotely by humans. So I personally don't see that as being too terribly different. It's still humans making the decisions. You know, humans make a lot of bad decisions, as we know, about, you know, whether to shoot or not, or whether to drop that bomb or not. And it's conceivable to me that autonomous weapons could make as good or better decisions about it. But we need to start thinking about those issues. What kinds of morals are we going to program into those more autonomous weapons? Somebody was suggesting recently, a moral philosopher, that this was going to become the golden age of moral philosophy, and that you could download your chosen moral philosophy into a machine or a weapon or or whatever. I don't know if that's true or
Can
not.
You literally codify exactly. your morals.
Yeah, yeah.
I wonder where, you know, I see a lot of people around me, the gig economy, I report a lot about that, freelancers, people sort of defining work differently. How does that fit into your idea of augmentation of work versus automation?
I don't know exactly. I mean, I think it's possible that as jobs get disaggregated by the introduction of smart machines, you know, more and more tasks getting taken over, that there will be more of that gig economy going on, that people will do parts of jobs that can't easily be done by machines. And one could argue even that a lot of the gig economy now, for example, in law, contract document reviewers were kind of people who did fairly low-paid document reviews previously done by $200, $300 an hour associates in big law firms. So that led to more of the gig economy. But then much of contract document review has been automated. So it's kind of a the gig economy is sort of the first step maybe toward automation, as is outsourcing in general. I think if you can outsource a job, then you can probably automate it in many cases.
And I think, you know, for a lot of people, correct me if I'm wrong, they're in the gig economy not because they don't want full-time work. There just isn't more of it. You said something a minute ago about that manufacturing could be coming back to the U.S., but that doesn't mean the jobs will come back. There will be more robots doing the work. So does that mean that if more people have to shift into areas of work that don't require humans, that there's just less room in the economy?
Well, overall, I think there will be somewhat less room and
just less work overall.
Yeah, less work overall. And, you know, that we may have to take some political and economic steps to deal with that. You know, some countries in Europe have experimented with guaranteed minimum basic incomes, for example, or we could have guaranteed jobs as we did in the Depression with the WPA and so on. But right now, I think, you know, what we're aiming for in this book is people who want to keep working and are open to the idea of learning. And I think if you're willing to focus on how these machines do work and try to see, you know, what you can do that might still be useful, chances are pretty good you'll still have a job. And that was true, by the way, in the Industrial Revolution. The people who understood how the power looms and the spinning jennies worked and so on had more than enough work to do. It was just the people who previously did that manual labor who were put out of a job.
I mean, it's kind of an odd question, but do you see a future where work is more important to a person's psyche than to their actual economic well-being?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's apparently already pretty important to people's psyches in that one Gallup survey we cited in the book, a global survey said a good job was the most important thing in life, more important than family or marriage or the religion or anything like that. And part of that is well-being, you know, economic well-being. But I think it's also psyche. Freud said to work and to love are the two most important things in life. So even if we did solve the problem of how to compensate people enough to live on, I think they still need things to do. And the early experiments with giving guaranteed minimum incomes without work are not very promising.
People
spend most of their time watching television and sleeping more. So
there'll be more work for psychiatrists then, I guess. I
mean, maybe, unless the machines get good at that too.
Oh my goodness. So in past eras, I think we sort of covered this, but in past eras, automation and upheaval led to new social institutions. And you sort of have touched on this, the idea of more education, more schooling, more public infrastructure. Do we need new public institutions now do we need to start thinking about laying sort of the basic infrastructure as we go forward into this new era of work?
Well, we do. And you know, we don't argue, as a lot of people do, you know, everybody should go into STEM education, you know, science and technology and engineering and math. But I think a lot of the education is going to be very targeted and vocational. So right now, there are tons of empty jobs, open jobs for people who understand manufacturing technology. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean, you know, you need to get a bachelor's degree in engineering. It means you just have to work very hard in some sort of vocational education environment. A community college could do a good job of it. We don't have very many that do, but it would certainly be relatively straightforward to create that environment.
So I guess I'd love to just hear, for someone who's maybe looking for work or wants to make sure they hold on to their job, in the very short term, how can they apply your five augmentation rules?
Well, I think you need to make a basic choice, and this is for people who are still in school, or if you're out of school and want to maintain your job. Do you want to work closely with computers or not? And if you do, that's probably the easier of the two. Then you can think about the kind of stepping in or stepping up, or I didn't talk about stepping forward, but
which one's that?
That's helping to build these new machines, you know, working for some vendor of them, IBM Watson, et cetera. And that, you know, they're hiring a lot of people. If you don't want to work with machines, then you need to find something that is either very human or very narrow, as I say. So that's where, you know, stepping aside and
donuts,
stepping narrowly come in.
As you mentioned.
That's right. Trading franchises of Dunkin' Donuts.
So we're going to leave it there. I've been speaking with Tom Davenport about his book called Only Humans Need Apply, Winners and Losers in the Age of Smart Machines. It was co-written with Julia Kirby. It's published by Harper Business. Tom, thanks so much for speaking with us today.
My pleasure. Thanks, Manoush.